When to come up. Maybe it'll be at the end. Did you start, Eric? Are you okay up there? All right. Keep your hands above where I can see them all the time. My name is David Farinella, and I'm an alcoholic. It's nice to be here. It's an honor for me to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's especially a privilege for me to talk here. I kind of feel like A.A. Sorbet talking between some of the big speakers that you guys are having up here. You know, got to clean the palate a little bit every once in a while. I'm sure that my sponsor will remind me of that later. And I think it's a real privilege for me to be able to talk, not just about, I think it's a real privilege for me to talk about what's happened in my life as a result of being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a time where I thought that it was all about, you know, what I looked like and what kind of car I drove and what kind of job I had and all of those things, the material things in my life. And the longer that I'm sober and the more that I see around Alcoholics Anonymous, what I realize is that length of sobriety or quality of sobriety has nothing to do with any sort of material thing. I've been tremendously blessed to, on the inside, be restored to a modicum of sanity that comes and goes as the hours pass in the day sometimes. And there are times when I feel like the luckiest man on earth, and I never felt that way 10 years ago, 10 and a half years ago. I certainly never thought that I would ever feel that way. And I'm blessed to be here. I do feel like it's important for me to say that while it's an honor to come and do these things, and I certainly appreciate the invitation, it's almost more important for me. You know, I can come up here and sound spiritual and sound wonderful and sound all these things, but it's almost more important to me what happens when I get in my car on the way home. You know, am I going to keep my fingers underneath the dashboard when the person cuts me off on the freeway, or am I going to be nice to my wife, or am I going to be tolerant and patient of other people in my life? And I think that that's one of the things that I have learned a lot about at my home group, because the guys there have really taught me a lot about how to live sober and be a productive member of society. And, you know, it's not like I got here and I was, you know, a whiz-bang poster child of sobriety. I certainly became willing and it became possible for me to do these things after a long period of time. This is nice, just in case. You know, I didn't grow up that way. I didn't come into Alcoholics Anonymous that way. You know, I was born into a half German and half Italian family, and couldn't figure out whether to attack or retreat for most of my youth. And I was very confused and very, you know, kind of lightheaded most of the time. And I just didn't know what to do or how to act. And that didn't help, certainly. Until I was on a golf course, and I could tell you the exact things that happened on that day. I was on a golf course, and my cousin Jimmy handed me a Heilman Special Export, and still comes in a green bottle and has a little German writing on it, and it came out of the bottom of a golf bag, so it had grass and dirt and stuff on the bottom of it. And I can remember, you know, it was a little sweaty. I'm still a little obsessed with this bottle, apparently. But I remember taking the pull off of that, and for the first time, you know, I felt comfortable, you know. In my head, I always thought that I was a little bit worse than anybody else, or a little bit not as smart or not as bright or whatever it was. And that day was the day, it was like the equalization day. And I can just remember having that first beer, and I loved it. I felt equal to everyone around me, and I felt like Arnold Palmer, because, you know, I was hitting 400-yard drives, and I can prove that because I never found a golf ball for the rest of the day. That actually happened 10 years sober, too, but that's something totally different. And I could just remember feeling that I was automatically comfortable, and I was automatically at peace. And I can remember that at that time, because I drank for the rest of the night and threw up and woke up the next morning. And I can remember that the feeling that I had the next morning didn't rival the comfortableness or the joy that I had the night before. You know, I can remember waking up, and I was spending some time with my soon-to-be best friend, the toilet, and I was depositing some things, you know, after a night of drinking in it. And I can remember my mom knocking on the door, and she said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, we must have got some food poisoning last night." And that started a pattern for me of getting drunk and doing asinine things. And she's here tonight, so this is probably the first time she's heard that. Of getting drunk and lying and doing asinine things and then trying to justify them. And that was my pattern, you know. For me, drinking at the beginning, the guys in my home group talk about their decades of drinking, and, you know, their first decade of drinking was purely fun, and they had a lot of good times, and their second decade of drinking was fun but a little bit of trouble, and their third decade, you know, it was getting a little troublesome, with maybe once or twice a week it was fun, and their fourth decade was clearly troubled. You know, they lost the business, and they lost the family, and the wife stayed, and they had lost all the planes and the boats and all that fun stuff. And you know, for me, my experience has been that in the first 6 months of drinking, it was a lot of fun, and I enjoyed myself, and I drank, you know, to dance with the girls, and I drank to have fun with the rugby guys, and I ran around and did silly things like you're supposed to do. And, you know, in the next 9 months of drinking were fun, but a little bit of trouble. And actually, in that second 9 months of drinking, I was intervened on for the first time. Apparently, a police officer didn't think it was wise that I had a beer between my legs at a high school football game, and decided that he would call the principal of my Catholic boys' school that I was going to and inform them that I was one of the miscreants there. There's your word for the night, the screen. There may be more. And I can remember that I was in this office of Ernie Bailey, the counselor at Cardinal Newman where I went to high school, and I can remember Ernie sat down and said, "Well, why don't you tell me what's going on?" And I would say, "Well, you know, nothing. I, you know, got this stuff going on, and I'm worried about this, and whatever it was just BS." And I can remember that then my friends came in, one by one. There was four of them. And one by one, each of them told me that I had a problem with drinking. And it was at that point that I realized that my problem necessarily wasn't drinking. My problem was selection of people to drink with. And I can remember thinking that, you know, well, they're done. They're next. And, you know, what I didn't remember is that they had carried me home for the past 6 months and deposited me in various places around my house and hidden beer for me and hid it. I can still remember that there is a bottle of gin hidden at Fitch Street in Healdsburg, where I grew up, because they took it away from me and hid it in a juniper bush, those bastards. I forgot about all the good things that those guys did and all the good things that those guys helped me through. You know, I thought that they were going to interfere with my life and my lifestyle, and I didn't want to have anything to do with them anymore. And apparently it was a mutual decision. I didn't realize that they got the better end of the deal until I got here. And I can remember that was the kind of time where, I mean, believe it or not, I was 16, 17 years old and my drinking turned a corner. And I didn't mean for it to turn a corner. I meant just to have fun, and I meant to be out there playing rugby with the guys, and I meant just to be one of the guys in the high school. And I certainly didn't mean to go that bad so fast. And it was a pretty interesting time, because I, at that young age, I started to drink heavier than I ever thought that I could. And it's not like I came by this by mistake. My father was a drunk, and I learned a lot from him early on in my life, and it was pretty interesting to me, just the fact that drinking changed on that day. You know, it went from being fun with all those guys to starting to drink, to start to hide from the shame in my life, and start to hide from the things that I was doing and the guilt that I was feeling, and I went through the next year or so, 2 years, with those kind of feelings, and my whole deal was, I truly wish that I knew that I was going to qualify for Alcoholics Anonymous, because I would have started carrying around a beaker with me to measure how much alcohol I drank. You know, I just drank as much as I could, as often as I could, whether it was a fifth, whether it was a beer, whether it was a pint, whatever it was. I just drank as much as I could, as hard as I could, for as long as I could, till either it fell down or I fell down, literally. And that's all it was. You know, it was just all about drinking and hiding and puking and starting all over. That was my whole deal. And I did that. You know, I did that successfully. One of the reasons was, you know, I was 16 or 17 years old and I looked 10, because I had something of a baby face back then. And the lucky thing, now I have the baby fat, so it's all evening out. See how that works? The only thing that I had going for me is that my family owned a liquor store. And I borrowed things from them on a fairly consistent basis, and I believe I paid most of that back. And I can remember that was my whole deal. You know, my friends could drink and buy beer because my friend Gordon looked 22, but I had to steal all my stuff. And I stole from anyone I could. I stole from all my friends. I stole from my family. I did what I had to do to get drunk. And it was, I don't know how I did it. My senior year in college, the first semester, or senior year, my senior year in high school, my first semester, my average was a 1.83, and that's not college grades, in case you didn't know. That's kind of like, you know, vocational school grades. That's not saying anything bad about that, but, you know, that's, in my family of high achievers, you don't go there, you go to Harvard or something like that. And I can remember that I didn't think I was going to be able to pull this one off. There was no recovery from this asinine behavior that I was doing. And I can remember that talking to my chemistry teacher at the time, who had just failed me, attributing to my 1.83, he said, well, I tell you what we're going to do. You want to go to college? I said, yes. He goes, you write as many letters of recommendation that you need to write. I'll sign my name and we'll get you into college. And I thought, well, this is great. Now I have a co-signer to my BS. And Dennis Bruno, this man, I love him. I see him every once in a while now. And he signed every letter. I didn't matter what I wrote. And he would sign it for me. And I pulled my GPA from a 1.83 to a 3.3 by taking PE, typing, teacher's assistant, and government. I think those are my big classes. And maybe an English class, I don't know. And I can remember that, I pulled it up to a 3.3, and I got the most improved student award at my little high school. And that's when I knew that BS will get you a lot farther than hard work. Because I don't know how I pulled it off, and I got accepted to, after I sent 3 checks and 4 applications to this college over here in the hill, St. Mary's College, and I now believe that they should hand out big books with acceptance letters. Because I got there, and it was all about being alone, and it was all about no responsibility, not like I was accountable to much then, but it was all about no one being around, and I can remember getting in, and I was renting a room in a house, and I can remember getting, you know, into that place, and my roommate, this guy named Tim, my roommate had a fake ID, and he could get really good pot, and this was like aces, you know, and now I understood what my cousins were talking about when they said that college was the time of their life, because this was the deal for me, and, you know, once a day, Tim would go to the store, and we'd get a 12-pack of Heilman Special Export, and, you know, maybe occasionally a bottle of gin, and it was a great thing. I absolutely loved it. I loved college just because I drank. I mean, and it was another one of those things where I lost all perspective of responsibility because it wasn't about being in college for education. You know, I should have just paid room and board at college because I didn't attend a class for the first 2 years there. I just was there to drink. I was just there to be alone, and I was just there to supposedly have fun. And I did for about a week, and then Tim got kind of bored with me because I'd locked my door, and it wasn't like I was socially drinking. I was just locking my door and hoping that the hot pocket that I had for dinner would stay down. And I was hammering the Henry Weinhardt and the whole bit. There were days where I'd wake up and I wouldn't go to class just because I couldn't. Days of Our Lives was much more important than lab. You know, you understand what I'm saying? There are things to learn at Days of Our Lives, real life lessons. And perhaps it is that way today. Mark, you had the day off today. No, sorry. And I can remember that's what it was all about for me. It became the period of time where I drank as often as I could, as much as I could. And it became the real serious point in my life where it was all about drinking to hide from any of those feelings that I had, any of that guilt that I had, any of that embarrassment that I had or shame that I had, either, you know, whether it was real or perceived, the actions that I took that made me feel that way. That's why I was drinking, and it wasn't fun. It was all about hiding, and it was all about taking it down as far as I could. And I think that I was pretty successful in that I never really got caught, or I never really got busted, or I never really got in too much trouble. You know, people just kind of didn't know where I was, and phones were left off for a long time and stuff like that. And I can remember somehow I made it through that freshman year, and I can remember I was in this program called the Integral Program at St. Mary's, where the beautiful thing is you don't ever have to take tests. You just have to write papers, and I'm a great BSer. In fact, that's what I do now. And I could write the paper, and I could get the C, and I could be okay. But in this integral program, they have these things called Don Rags, where you have 4 professors, and you sit with your professors, and they talk with you in the room in the third person. So my professors would say, it seems to me that Mr. Farinella has a problem with discipline. It seems to me that Mr. Farinella doesn't take college very seriously. It seems to me that Mr. Farinella might want to choose another major next semester. Perhaps even another college. And I can remember, there's another one of those things like being intervened on, but, you know, with guys with dresses on because they're brothers. And I can remember, I'm kind of glad he's not here tonight. And I can remember that it was another one of those situations where those guys didn't understand me, and I don't really want to have anything to do with them, and I don't really care about them. So here's another group of people or another group of friends that I discounted wholeheartedly. And I can remember that, you know, I changed my major and I hid away in a different program and, and I started to do those things, and I went back my sophomore year, and it was right around that time that my brother, who I had been grooming, because in high school and early in college, I had become sort of a young, snobby, preppy kid, and I was wearing the Sperry's with the no socks, and I was wearing the right animals on my, the Garanimals on my shirts, and I was doing the right preppy things, and I was grooming my young brother to become the next preppy kid from our family, and teaching him that no, we wanted polo people, not alligators. That was more expensive. And I can remember that I was grooming this kid, and I came home after my first year of college, and I don't know what transpired or what happened, but when I walked in the door, he had hair down to his shoulders, he had 17 earrings in both ears, he had torn jeans, he had a black leather jacket. He looked like he hadn't been asleep for 3 days, because he hadn't been asleep for 3 days, if you know what I mean. And he had suddenly gone from my little, protege, preppy kid, to like Healdsburg's best drug dealer. And I didn't have anything to do with that, and I'm kind of bummed. But I remember a couple of the great things happened there is that the heat was off of me. And suddenly Philip became the identified patient. That was aces, I gotta tell you. And I just remember feeling like, okay, this is better because he's younger and maybe he won't screw up as much or something. And I just remember feeling semi-relieved, because he could score good pot too, and feeling semi-relieved about the whole thing. And then I went back to college, because I had to, because it wasn't that good there. And I can remember that I would go away to college, and at this time I was living on campus with a bunch of people, who sometimes drank the way that I drank, but a lot of the times looked at me really weird when I would stay up and they would go to bed. But I can remember I started to get phone calls from home, and Mom would start saying, well, Philip didn't come home again last night, or, the local gang took Philip out and, beat him up or terrorized him or did his car thing. And I can remember that I started to get these phone calls, and I didn't really know what to do. And that was in September of that year. And in October of 1986, I got a phone call from, I guess it was my mom, and she said, your father checked himself into a rehab center, an alcohol rehab center down in Los Angeles, and he doesn't want to hear from you, and he doesn't really care. He just wants to let you guys know where he's going to be for the next 45 days. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because he's never told us that in the past 5 years, so I don't know why he'd want us to know now. But that's what happened, and slowly the idea of sobriety was introduced. Not promising in my family. I mean, it wasn't something I was like jumping for joy about, but I got the idea that perhaps there were people out there living sober and feeling comfortable about it. And my dad got sober in October. They shipped my brother into a drug rehab, alcohol rehab, in December. And it was right about that time that I, after going through the family education series and the guys started to, they were talking to the identified patients, but I clearly belonged in that program with them. What I learned during those family education series is that alcohol, it doesn't matter. Alcohol doesn't care if you're 35 or you're 15. And alcohol doesn't care if you wear the right Garanimals on your shirt or if you're sleeping on the corner. And alcohol doesn't care what you look like or what religion you are or any of those things. Alcohol is going to take you down. And I learned it there only because I saw it. Only because I saw that these kids were burning it down harder than I ever thought that I could. And I was amazed. And during these family sessions, the kids would talk about their feelings, and then the siblings would talk about their feelings, and then the parents would talk about their feelings. And the scary thing is that I identified more with the patients than with any other party, and I started to really see what alcoholism was. And at 17, I woke up one morning, and I had done a little landscaping. I put some rocks in my forehead after drinking too much. I'd fallen on a parking lot, and little did I know that rock gardens would be such a big thing later on, but I woke up that morning, I was 17 years old, and I can remember thinking that alcohol was my problem, and I can remember thinking that maybe I shouldn't drink that much, or maybe I should just tone it down a little bit, and then I reflected back to my father, who had done some wonderful things in his life, like me, and I kind of reflected back that, screw it, I'm just going to die a drunk. I'm just going to die alcoholic. I'm just going to die drinking. And I don't care. I don't want to live a life. I don't really care about a life. I just want to get drunk. And that was 17. And in 19 or 18, I was listening to these kids talk about their alcoholism. And I started to have those thoughts again that maybe I was the identified patient. And this was the real scary time of my life because, you know, that was December and January, and I started to really question how I was drinking. And during one of the conversations with my brother, I made a deal with him. I made the deal with him that ensures that you're alcoholic if you make this deal. I'm a firm believer in this. I said, as long as you don't drink, Philip, I won't drink. Even though you have the problem, I won't drink. I'm the older brother, you're the younger brother, you and me. Prick fingers or whatever you want to do, but I swear to you that I'm not going to drink as long as you don't drink. This is it, you and me, baby. And I thought I was going to do it. I really believed in my heart that I wouldn't drink as long as Philip didn't drink. And Philip graduated from the Adolescent Recovery Center on February 11th of 1987. And on February 13th, his older brother that had sworn to him that he was never going to drink again was sleeping in a curtain at the Claremont Hotel. The woman that I had taken to the dance at the Claremont Hotel was now with some guy named Tony in a different bedroom. My name wasn't Tony at the time. Neither is it now. And they were having fun, apparently. My friend Art, my roommate Art, was going to, you know, bed, and my other friend Matthias was going to bed, and I can remember that I didn't understand, because there were still, you know, a quarter of a sphere in a party ball, that why these people were going to go to bed. There were still Coors Light to drink, for God's sakes, and, you know, whatever. And you drink bad things when you're drunk. And I didn't understand, and they didn't understand why I still had to drink, but... I said, fuck it, my brother, excuse me, oh, see, only one, this one, that's $15 at my home group. Let me see, where was I? I didn't understand why I was, you know, that drunk and they were just, you know, having fun, and I didn't understand why it was all about me trying to catch up for those past 3 days. Because I was trying to catch up for those past 3 days, and I went to bed, and I woke up that next morning, and I felt the exact same things that I had felt every other day that I had gotten drunk. You know, people talk about the hideous four horsemen, and that's when I started to become aware that I was terrified every time I took a drink, and that's when I became aware that, you know, my friend Matthias, he'd have one beer and then go do something, and I didn't understand why I had one beer and then 43 other ones, and I didn't understand why he could seemingly live a life and drink at the same time. The third one that I remember is frustration, and I can remember very clearly not understanding and being frustrated why I couldn't drink like him, or anybody, it doesn't have to be just him, or anybody else, you know, in my family, those people just have one beer at wine or 18 beers at dinner, but they don't get in fights and they don't tell their wives what they think about them and those things after they have a drink. And I didn't understand. And over the next 6 months, I developed a sense of despair that I never really thought that I could ever feel. And I tried, I revamped that promise on Monday morning because, you know, Sunday, it was like basketball season, so you had to drink during that time. And Coors Light, of course. And I can remember Monday, I revamped that decision, and I said, I'm not going to drink. This is the time. And I didn't. You know, that was in February, and I didn't drink for a whole... 34 days, and it was St. Patrick's Day at a college where their mascot is an Irish knight, and they had Old Coors Light, I believe they were serving, and Mickey Budweiser, and I can remember that it was all about, well, they're drinking, and I'm not, and they're laughing, and I'm not, and that guy Tony is dancing with my date again. That really pisses me off. No, I'm just kidding. And I figured, no, I'm just gonna have one beer. I'm just gonna have one. It'll be fine. I'll just relax, enjoy the music, and blow a bagpipe or two, and just relax. And I had the first beer, and then all of a sudden it turned gray again. You know, my whole world just automatically seemed, the rationality in my life turned off. And I went through the next 6 months trying everything that I could think of to control and enjoy my drinking. I drank in Moraga, I went to Santa Rosa, I went to San Luis Obispo, I went to Mendocino, I tried drinking with a full moon and a quarter moon and a half moon, and I tried reading my horoscope and seeing what it was going to say that day about drinking. Amazingly, never said anything about drinking. And I can remember I tried to find the magic potion. Maybe if I mix this chemical with this alcohol, or maybe if I drink homemade wine or domestic beer or imported beer, or, you know, maybe whatever it was, you know, gin with just tonic or whatever. And I tried everything that I could think of at that time. Little did I know that in a year that I would come into Alcoholics Anonymous and learn a bunch of different ways to drink. I can remember sitting in meetings when I was early sobriety, and there's a guy named Ed Nicolini who's passed on, and he had about 90,000 different ways to drink that I never even thought of. And damn, I didn't, you know, I'd hear Ed talk and I'd get pissed off. And I tried everything that I could think of, and at the end of it, I was on a camping trip, and I was with my best friend Scott, and I was hanging out, and we were having fun, and Scott knew about my pact with my brother because Scott and I were pretty close, and Scott had actually was one of the guys that carried me home a couple of times and knew that I shouldn't drink probably, and Scott looked at me and he said, "You know what? Here's the deal. I understand this whole thing about you and Philip, but he's down in Healdsburg, and we're up here in Mendocino, and." You know, I wouldn't tell him. He'd never find out about this. And I said, okay. And he goes, you know, and it's a beautiful day. It was 10 o'clock in the morning. And he said, it's a beautiful day. And we can just have a beer, you know. Don't worry about it. I said, okay. And then he said the clincher. And he said, you know, we're throwing horseshoes. And I thought, I never tried drinking and throwing horseshoes at the same time. Maybe this is like the magic key. If I carry like a horseshoe in my pocket, maybe this is the deal, you know. It's not the deal. For those of you who just had a light bulb go off, you know, friends don't let friends horseshoe and drink. And I can remember thinking that I thought this was going to be it. I thought this was going to be the answer. I thought this was going to be the thing. And I can remember waking up that next morning, and it's at this point in my story that I've done a little editing, because at one point I used to say that I heard a voice tell me. However, a guy named Clancy, I heard say one time that if you're hearing voices, you're psychotic. I don't want to be psychotic, so now I say the original thought came to me that I didn't have to live this way ever again. And it's not that wasn't something I had read and had popped back into my head. That wasn't something that had been, you know, like taught to me and I recalled. That was something that I had never even dawned on me. And I wish that I could attribute it to my education. I wish that I could attribute it to, you know, the right animals on my shirt, or the car, or the girl, or whatever it was. I wish I could attribute it to those things, but I have to attribute it today to the grace of God. And that isn't something easily said, because what that does, it takes all of my power away. And it makes me reliable on a higher power. And I, you know, I didn't want to admit that. You know, I always wanted to think that, well, I could do this. You know, I could stay sober. I'm 19. I'm strong enough, and God damn it, I'm in college and I'm studying governments around the world, and I could do this. I don't have to do what Philip does or my dad does. I don't have to go to those ANA meetings and hear about airlines or pilots or changing tires or whatever the hell they talk about there. And I don't have to do anything. So from July to November, I didn't do anything. You know, I was just sober. You know. Get away from me. And I can remember that my brother, who was, you know, was pretty active in Alcoholics Anonymous at that time, was watching me. And I think he was laughing about me a lot, because, and I'll tell you why in a second, because my belly button birthday is in November. And for my 20th birthday, my brother gave me a big book. And I didn't need it, frankly. But now I had some information about Alcoholics Anonymous. And for Christmas in that year, he gave me a 12 and 12. I still have those two books, and apparently I had to get my own literature and my own little pamphlets, because he wasn't coughing those up. But then he called me and he said, "Why don't you come with me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous?" I said, "I don't know. I'm up here, and you're in Healdsburg, and I don't want to drive." And he said, "Come on, I'm going to get a year chip, Oscar share. My name's David, and I'm an alcoholic." I said, "You know, I don't want to drive that way, and it's AA, and, you know, I don't need that type of thing. I've got the book, and I've read those 12 things. I've done them. Or at least nearly memorized that there are 12 of them." And I can remember that I didn't really want to participate in that aspect of his life. And he said, "Well, come on, you could get a little chip. You could get a six-month chip." And I thought, well, now they're going to recognize me. Now we're happy. So I'm going to get something for this deal for my gas money to drive up there. And I walked into this meeting up in in the Salvation Army in Healdsburg, and my brother walked in, and this woman gave him a hug, and then he moved away, and she said, "Oh, David, it's very nice to see you. We've heard a lot about you." And that automatically pissed me off, because I didn't want, you know, I still had a little modicum of pride, for, you know, God's sake. I didn't want anyone to be talking about me. And then she came up and gave me a big hug, and I thought that was really weird, because I never met this woman before. And we sat in the back, and, you know, I'd like to welcome the new people here. And if you can relate to this, I sure hope that you can laugh at this, because I sat in that meeting, and I don't know if they, like, sacrificed goats. I don't know if there was chanting. I don't know if guys were burning incense, or there's, like, you know, percussion players in the back. I have no clue what happened in that meeting. If they had, like, done Tibetan chants, I wouldn't have known. I was just sitting back there, you know, blank. At that point, my mind, it was like a gerbil with a new habit trail. You know, I was confused. I was going 850,000 miles an hour, and these people were looking at me, and why are they looking at me? And oh my God, that woman hugged me. What does that mean? I don't want to know anything about that. And now I'm going to give this chip, and now a guy hugged me. What the hell is this about? And it's just crazy. And I got back in my car, and 850 miles an hour back to Moraga, you know, back where I could be with the people with the animals on their shirts. But what I found, and what I hope that you find here, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, is I found laughter, and I found joy. And I looked in some of these people's eyes, you know, when my eyes were on the floor, and I saw a certain lightness in them that I had never seen before. Maybe I'd seen it in my family. We're a pretty fun family. Maybe I'd seen it in some of my friends, but I certainly hadn't felt that for years. I certainly hadn't smiled. I certainly hadn't laughed. I certainly hadn't been able to hug a man, you know, any of those things. And I can remember that I walked out of that meeting not so much hearing great spiritual principles, or this is what you had to do to stay sober, and this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you don't do it, you're going to die, or, you know, I didn't hear any of that stuff. I saw a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw a lot of love, and I saw a lot of laughter, and I saw a lot of joy, and that's what I fell in love with. That's what I fell in love with. So when I came back to St. Mary's for my junior year, the end of my sophomore year, you know, I decided, you know, maybe I should check out an AA meeting, and 2 months later, after that, I walked into my first meeting down here, and I walk into this meeting, and it was at St. Mary's College, and you know, you figure you're going to meet young people, and I walk in there, and it was all old people. I was damn near the only one there that had hair, and they all kind of like sat around, or, you know, put their heads above their heads, and you know, they all just relaxed and kicked back, and they didn't really do anything. And I thought, oh Christ, I'm never going to understand what these people are talking about. You know, these are the guys that drank the decades. You know, they lost the boat in the car. I've never even been in a boat, you know. And I can remember, I just thinking, I'm not going to identify with these people. And I sat down and I listened to them, and I heard what they said. And the kind of thing happened to me where it was like, I did that. I felt that. Oh, wow. I didn't think anybody else thought like that. And I sat back in that meeting, and that was the kind of beginning of a hopeful existence that I lived. And I can remember that I stuck my hand up, they might have just pointed at me because it was so freaking obvious I was new. And five guys came over to me and said, "It's nice to see you here. It's nice to have young people in Alcoholics Anonymous." And I would just like to say this about that. If you think that it's difficult to get sober young, I got sober during the Reagan administration. That was the hard part about it. I had campaigned for the old guy. But I can remember that they came over and they talked to me. And you know, I firmly believe today that if it wasn't for those five men, I wouldn't be alive today. You know, there was a guy named Dick, and there was a guy named Bill, and there was a guy named Frank, there was a guy named George, there was a guy named Glenn. And they walked over to me, and they started to show me Alcoholics Anonymous on a very personal and real level. I saw all those guys today. I went to a funeral for a woman that was at that meeting was her home group. I saw those guys today. And anytime I see them, it just brings back that memory, because I wouldn't be here. You know, the stuff that I talked about at the beginning, I wouldn't have any of this if it wasn't for those five guys. I owe those five guys my life. And I would do anything in the world for those five guys. And they did funny things to me, like they would talk to me, and they would tell me the truth, and they'd walk with me and they'd show me things, and I can remember that I would walk in there and they'd kind of light up and they'd say hi because, you know, I was the young Messiah in their group and the new fresh blood, and then, you know, they'd talk for a few minutes and they'd look at me and then they'd kind of look away and I'd sit down, and then this one guy, this bald guy, of course, came over and I was sitting there drinking my coffee and I looked up and was blinded by his little pate, you know, and he said, "Are you keeping the plug in the jug?" And I was irritated because I was, you know, 7 months sober, and they didn't recognize apparently what a spiritual giant I had become in those 7 months, and how comfortable I looked in my own skin. And I said, "Obviously, I'm keeping the plug in the jug." He said, "You're not doing anything else, are you?" I said, "I don't know what you're talking about." He said, "You're not like smoking anything or putting anything in your nose, are you?" I said, "No," and he said, "Good, because that's like changing staterooms from the Titanic." And I thought, "Wow, that's really festive. I'm glad that, you know, perhaps your sobriety is contingent upon little slogans, but I need, you know, like real help. And I need like real direction. I don't need simplification." The best part about that whole line right there is that he's a nuclear physicist. And he was my first sponsor. And I can remember he would talk, and you know what? He would talk to me like no one else had ever talked to me before. And I can remember that I was at this point, it's amazing, you know, my sponsor said the ego has amazing recuperative powers. It's amazing how much better I thought I was at that time than I really was, because he would say things like, you know, "There's these things," and I would say, "What?" And he would say, "There's 12 of them." It was like, you know, it was like Pictionary. "We're going to draw it out for you. And there's 12 of them, and you might want to think about them." And I thought, well, okay, I've read them, clearly understand them, know that I can't drink, know there's a God, hate people, should apologize. That's all. Got them. Move on. Let's go help somebody. Come on. We're moving on. When do I hit the circuit? And I can remember one time, I was absolutely just miserable, I was crazy, and I was telling him what I thought about Alcoholics Anonymous and how it should work, clearly because I had the right answers. And we were up in the Oakland Hills in his little house, and he was grinding coffee beans, like you do in the Oakland Hills, and he was grinding his little coffee bean and making coffee, and he said, "You know," he paused, and he said, "You know, do you know what I do for a living?" I said, "Well, I know that, you know, you work somewhere in nuclear physics." And he goes, "Uh-huh, yeah, that's what I do, you know. A lot of education goes into that." And I said, "I'm clear on that." And I think he maybe, you know, has those pilot higher and deeper letters after his name, the PhD. And he said, "You know, when I got checked into the recovery center back in Minnesota, the nurse said one thing to me." And I thought, okay, this should be good. She said, "Glenn, I've seen a lot of people too smart to get this program, but not a lot of people too dumb." And he paused and looked at me. Then he started grinding his beans again. And my thought was, well, clearly, that's your problem. I thought he was asking me for an opinion about his life. And apparently he was trying to teach me a story, and that never dawned on me until I was 5 years sober. But I can remember thinking, you know, that, okay, you know, maybe I'll start to think about Alcoholics Anonymous as more than just a place to go on Friday nights and, you know, Monday nights. And maybe I'll start to, like, look at this stuff. And he slowly, very slowly led me through the steps. And I didn't want to write a four-step, quite frankly. I vacillated a lot between hating everyone and not hating anybody. Didn't understand resentment. I did the Hazelden guide the first time around. I didn't understand intolerance and impatience and, you know, good things like that and how they applied to my life. And I can remember that one point I was working in a magazine. I'm a writer by trade. And I was working in a magazine, and he called me up and he said, "How's that four-step coming?" And I said, "Haven't done it." He said, "You're supposed to be in my house tomorrow." I said, "I know, I don't think it's going to happen." He said, "What do you do for a living?" I said, "I'm a writer." He said, "Write your goddamn four-step." Hung up the phone. And that's the kind of loving support that I got in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't understand how people could say they love me until I could love myself. I got, "They'll yell at you until you can yell back." You know, kind of the direction I got before I came up here is don't screw it up. That's the kind of, like, home group direction you get. And I can remember that this guy, like, took me through the steps, and he showed me what a four-step was, and And he laid it out, and I wrote it down, and I wrote it down, and I got it done, and it was only 18 months later. And stellar poster boy example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I sat down, and I read him that fourth step, and I started through the process of the fifth step. And I can remember sitting there, and I didn't know what I was, you know, I was just, and I hate him, and whatever, and the whole bit. And he fell asleep, and he woke up at one point and said, "Do you want to get some coffee?" And I thought, maybe that would be a good idea, asshole. And maybe you want to stay awake next time. I'm pouring out some delicate thoughts here. And he fell asleep, and he woke up, he fell asleep, and he woke up, and, you know, three or four times. And whatever. And I can remember that I was sitting there, and the times that he was awake, I felt closer to God than I ever felt in my entire life. I felt cleansed. I felt comfortable, and I felt like I had never felt. It was as if I was back in that first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And not only was I seeing the joy in other people's eyes, but I was starting to feel it. And I never thought that it could be this good sober. I never thought that it could be this comfortable sober. And I never thought that I'd be this happy. And I told that man things that I never thought that I would tell any other human being on the face of the earth. And I can remember that I left there from the Oakland Hills to drive to my office in Walnut Creek, and I have never felt more comfortable. And I truly believe when it talks in the book, Big Book, about the fifth step promises, that came true for me. And I am eternally grateful for that man putting up with my BS for that length of time so that I could find that. Because that to me is Alcoholics Anonymous. He had, you know, lasers to build or whatever the hell he does. And he took his time out of his day to listen to me. And he showed me Alcoholics Anonymous. And over the next 6 months or so, or past 6 months, or whatever it was, as my life was falling apart back then sober, and I started to hit an emotional bottom, that man would come over, or he'd call me and say, "How you doing today, kid?" And I'd go, "Not good, you know, this happened, and this happened, and this happened." He said, "Why don't you come over to my house?" I said, "All right, he's going to grind me coffee beans again. Okay, I can deal with this." And he said, "I love you, and I want you to just come and sit over here." And I can remember I went over to his house, and little did I know that he had ulterior motives, but I went over to his house and I cried for a little while and I got it out of me, and then he kind of looked at me and said, "Okay, let's go." And I thought, "Oh, we're going to go help new guys, you know, you're going to save the world, you're going to go carry the message, I'm getting on the circuit." And he drove me to the airport, and I can remember that he pulled me outside, and he had told me to wear bad shoes, and we walked outside, and he looked at me and he said, "Do you know how to dig a fence post hole?" And I thought, this doesn't say anything about it in the steps. I've read those things, I know this. But he took me outside and I dug fence post holes for this guy. I don't know how many I dug. But what happened is I was in a safe place. And he was getting free labor, and I was learning about Alcoholics Anonymous. Every so often I drive by that goddamn fence and I say, "That's me. You couldn't be there if it wasn't for me." And a week later he got one of those tractors that you could dig the holes with. Apparently I wasn't fast enough. And I can remember that as sobriety grew and as things started to happen, I started to rely more and more. You know, I called him more than once a quarter. You know, that was my whole deal, is that, you know, I'd call him every 3 months, and he'd hear my voice, he'd put the phone down, go put in Cinderella for his daughter, and then he'd come back every once in a while and go, "Uh-huh." And then I'd hear the phone click, and then I'd go down. And I was just jabbering, and I wasn't doing anything to stay sober. And what happened is I went to this Friday night meeting. This guy named Dave came up to me and said, "We have a meeting on Mondays, and you can come. In fact, there's a meeting on Mondays, and Wednesdays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays. There are more than one meeting a week that you can attend, my young friend." And I started to go with him to a Monday night meeting, and I started to go with him to a Wednesday night meeting. And I slowly started to get into not just living sober, or not just being sober, but living sober. You know, at that time, I was unemployed. I was unemployable sober. I didn't understand anything about responsibility. And I was not applying any one of the traditions in my life. And I can remember just feeling miserable. And they would come to me and they would say, I had lost the job at the magazine and I had lost the girlfriend and the little Celica was not doing too good. And the Granimals were kind of wearing out at the collar, so I couldn't wear those anymore. And my life was slowly falling apart. And I can remember thinking, I was laying in bed, and I can remember thinking that this isn't what I signed on for. This isn't sober. This isn't comfortable. I know I can't drink anymore, but what am I going to do? Because this isn't what I want. And, you know, I'd go to that Monday night meeting and a Wednesday night meeting, and And guys would say, well, what are you doing? And I would say, well, I feel afraid. And they would say, what are you doing? And I would say, well, I'm feeling a little insecure. And they would say, well, what are you doing? And after about 2 years, I finally understood that they were asking me what I was doing. And I never knew the correlation between doing and feeling. You know, it's not the other way. It's not feeling and doing. It's doing and feeling. And I never understood that. But I slowly started to, like, go to work. And I slowly started to actually turn the assignments in when they were due and answer my phone and be responsible and shave and most of my, all my face. And I slowly started to learn how to not only be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I slowly started to learn that Alcoholics Anonymous just doesn't happen for me tonight from 8 o'clock to 9:30. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous for me happens tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock when the buzzer goes off and I got to get up and start my day. Or 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the morning on Monday when I got to get up and get to work and do my thing. That is a bigger example of Alcoholics Anonymous than anything that I could ever think or say while I'm in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they slowly started to teach me that this is what it's all about, you know. And I slowly started to apply those things. And I didn't mean to, but, you know, I started to be successful, you know. And it's not like I'm, you know, Joe Blow, successful writer right now, but I'm a lot farther along today than I was last year and the year before and the year before that. And, you know, that's not me. It's not like I sat down and had a business plan and this is what I'm going to do and this is where I'm going to go and this is where I'm going to be. It was, you know, guys like Steve and Chuck and Glenn and Rick and these guys that kind of just pointed the way and said, now you go there. And I would say, but I'm, you know, feeling a little afraid. And they would say, now you go there. And they really spelled it out for me. And that first sponsor, when those things changed, when my relationship with him changed, and I had to get a new sponsor, for a time I decided that because I was a government major and I understood about democracy in its purest form, that what I would do is form a sponsorship committee. And that we would have elections and we'd have weekly polling places. And any time that I had a decision to make or any time that I had something to decide about, I'd call five guys. Three versus two, three wins, piece of cake, no big deal. And sometimes I was the deciding vote. You know, you got to stand up for yourself. And I did that. And I was accountable to 16 different guys and I was telling everybody my business and nobody knew the real truth because I was tailoring it for everybody else. And you know, I tell one guy something, I tell the other guy something, and then I tell the third guy something else. And, you know, amazingly, I was getting more and more miserable as the time was going by. And I remember some guy pulled me aside and said, you know, maybe you want to get one sponsor. And I thought, well, I'm doing so fine right now. I don't really need just one. I need, you know, 18 of them. And he pulled me aside and said, you know, it's time for you. It's time for you to get a new sponsor. And I was 5 years sober, and I had to become willing again, to do whatever it took to stay sober, like I was 30 days sober, like I was a day sober, like I was a year sober. And I had always thought, you know, I called this guy and he's sober longer than I'm alive. And I thought that at 5 years sober, I was ready. I was ready for like the real AA program. I was ready for like the secret chapter that they only gave to guys over 5 years. And I was ready for like the secret 12. You know, they're going to turn the steps around and they're going to be like, oh, the magical part. And I was clearly ready because I was, you know, comfortable and happy and joyous and free and whatever else you were supposed to be. And I could say what you're supposed to say. And I can remember that I thought really that this is what it's all about. And I called him up and I said, it's my 5-year anniversary. And he said, oh, that's great. And I said, well, I'm ready, you know, for the secret stuff, for the real big book. And he said, that's interesting. He said, what are you doing tonight? And I think it was a Tuesday I went to. I said, I don't know. Something was on TV. I have no idea what's on TV anymore. And he said, I'll see you at the meeting. And he hung up the phone. And we went over to the meeting. And what I learned is that during that meeting, we were sitting there. And after the meeting, he went over and talked to a new guy. And he started to talk to the new guy about Alcoholics Anonymous. And he started to show this new guy about Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I learned is that there's no secret chapter. It's the secret action. And I got very afraid because I heard people talk that between 5 and 10 years, you kind of drift away and you kind of don't become as active. And I was afraid. I was truly afraid that I was going to be one of those guys that was going to get just drift away. And so my sponsor said, well, here's what you're going to do. And I thought, and he had just become the secretary of the Danville speaker meeting. I thought, well, I'm going to be, you know, the permanent How It Works reader. I'm going to be up there and people will see me once a month and I'll be very, you know, prominent. And he said, you're going to make coffee. And I said, I don't want to make coffee. And he said, and then you're going to pick up cigarette butts afterwards. And I did. And I did that for 18 months. And I slowly got introduced to the fellowship. And I slowly got to see not just what happens when you go to meetings, but I started to see all the stuff that goes around Alcoholics Anonymous and applying it outside and doing the things that you do around here. And I can remember that I met more people in those 18 months than I ever thought. I'll tell you, it's very humbling to walk into Diablo Foods in Danville and buy cups for 1,800 people because the cups ran out. They look at you weird when you have all those styrofoam cups stuck in your thing. And I can remember that I slowly got introduced to all those things. As that time came and went, I started to learn that Alcoholics Anonymous can't be compartmentalized. It can't be all about just being AA here. I have to take Alcoholics Anonymous into my home, and I have to take Alcoholics Anonymous into my business. I have to take Alcoholics Anonymous into my friends, and I have to take Alcoholics Anonymous into every aspect of my life. I can't just be AA guy when I'm here. You know, I have to take these principles and apply them in all my life. Amazing things have happened in my professional life. I've actually had to call people three times to tell them that they paid me too much money, and every time they say, well, we'll cut you a new check. And it's happened three times, and I figure that the next time it happens, I'm done. You know, I'm keeping the goddamn extra money. That's $30 now I owe the group. And I can remember that I learned, but what happened when I turned the check in, or what happened when I became responsible, is that those people trusted me. And those people knew that I wasn't going to shuck and jive. And those people knew when they said that the story was due on the 15th, that I was actually going to turn it in on the 15th. And those people knew that I was reliable. And that's not me. You know, that's not me. My deal is to get away with it as long as I can and just escape by as fast as I can and cash the checks. And I learned about being a professional. I learned about being a successful human being. And, you know, one of the greatest things that's happened to me is that I got very active in a home group. And I have to say that all of Alcoholics Anonymous came down to me to a couple of different things. First off, that I became accountable to a sponsor on a one-on-one basis. Second off, that I became accountable to a home group and that I was there. My home group is Wednesday Night Nurse Group number 3. And then I'm there every Wednesday night. And I do things around there at that group that, you know, I've become involved in service in that group. And I slowly have gotten to see what happens when you become involved in people's lives. And I got to sponsor guys, and I can remember the first example is that I knew that Alcoholics Anonymous really worked is that I told this guy that I sponsored, who asked me to be a sponsor, to do something. I'd never done it before, and I don't know how much I've done it lately, but I suggested something. I told him to do it, and he called me 2 hours later and said that it worked. And the only reason that I knew to say that was because my sponsor or someone around me had told me the same thing. And I have to say that, you know, I'd love, like I said at the beginning, I'd love to, you know, point out that all of these things are tremendous because I'm a member of Alcoholics. I'm not reading off of this, by the way. Because I'm a tremendous member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think what happens when you do good things happen. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine today who's 17 years sober, 15 years sober, and he said, it's not about what you did yesterday anymore. It's not about what you did 2 years ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago. It's not about any of that stuff. It's all about what you're doing today, not only to stay sober and not have a drink, but what you're doing to live a good life and live the good purpose. And I have to say that at 10 years sober and a little bit over, that I have to become more willing today to do the things that I have to do in order to stay comfortable. Because it became painfully obvious to me that Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't necessarily about just coming here and saying good things. It was about standing up here with clear eyes and being comfortable and happy enough to say, you know, that I'm here and that I want to be sober and I'll do what it takes, you know. And I just would like to close by saying, you know, we're entering into the Tet Offensive of sobriety, you know, the big three, the big three horsemen of, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's Eve. And the question I have to ask myself as I go into these things is, what am I going to do to stay sober? What am I going to do to be of service? And what am I going to do not to be a victim? And what am I going to do to add to these people's lives? You know, and that's another thing. I wish that I had thought of this myself, but it's directly out of the big book. And during these times of joy and during these times of happiness, what I found is that I can either turn to a sponsor, turn to a home group, more importantly, turn to a higher power, say, I don't know what to do here. Could you help me, please? And at the end of the day, like I will tonight, I'll get on my knees or I'll get into bed and I'll close my eyes for just a second and I'll say, thank you very much. And that's what I'd like to say tonight. Alcoholics Anonymous in the past 10 years has given me more joy and more happiness and more self-respect and dignity inside than I could have ever expected. And all I want to say is thank you very much.